It is the No Filter Sports Podcast. The date we are recording this is May 28th, 2020. Eli Zarrett here along with Bob Page and Danny McClain. Good morning, gentlemen. We have a great guest
Who's he talking to, Danny?
Well, what did he just say? He just rang my bell. My daughter's birthday is today. Thank you for reminding me.
I'm sure you're referring to the gentleman line, but whatever.
Thank you, Eli.
Just a phrase. I'm thinking, I'm reading all this going on with the NBA and Major League Baseball and the NHL. They're formulating these plans, and my mind is spinning and saying, you know, I don't know. Everybody must feel deep down that the wheels are spinning a little faster than they really should. But the reason is that it's the calendar. And if you turn 70 like I have, and you're as old as Bob is and Denny, as you know that the calendar in life is that ever silent stalking threat. You know, each day, my goodness, what happened to today? What is this? Another a month? Didn't this year really go fast? So as time crunches in on these leagues, they're making big decisions, risky decisions. Adam Silver, the NBA, who has probably the best relationship with his players or any of the commissioners, said a couple weeks ago, no decisions we make will be risk-free, as the number of days, obviously, to solve all these things whittles down. So
I don't understand why these guys haven't called us. You and I together, Eli, made the decision for everybody on the last show. It's too much BS. There's too much crap associated with this, too much controversy. We'll see you in 2021, fellas. Just let's not play sports the rest of the year. And yet here's Max Scherzer, the former Tiger pitcher and vagabond free agent, in headlines on Thursday. He ripped MLB owners for their negotiating tactics, and he said Major League players aren't going to negotiate at all anymore at this point. I don't know if Max is the right guy to do that, making 30-some million a year. But, I mean, let's just blow it off.
Well, let's qualify Max, too. He is one of the eight players on a Major League Baseball Players Association executive subcommittee. So he's got an awful lot of influence with the process and who he's going to talk to, and he's got everybody's ear. What Max is talking about is the owners and the players agreed to that, which we talked about before. They agreed to a contract based upon the number of games they were going to play. Now the owners want to change that. And I'll give you an example. Trout, who makes $30 million a year this coming year, all right, if he just takes the prorated money and they play 82 games, he makes about $16 to $17 million. If he does this other program that the players are or that the owners are proposing, he makes less than $6 million. So
how do you live on that kind of money? I don't know how you live on it.
It's impossible. I don't know how you buy a car, buy the
stop
gas.
It. That's so
you hate that. I know.
I hate that.
You hate that. I know.
You also somewhat misquoted Scherzer. You left something out. And he said the quote was, we have a previously negotiated a pay cut.
Right.
The version of prorated salaries. No, Bob said, he quoted him saying, and he said, there's no need to negotiate anymore. And I'm glad to hear, and there's no justification to accept the second pay cut based on the current information the union has received. In other words, the Major League players have always doubted the owner's books. There's so many clever ways to disguise what you're making or what you have. And so he says, quote, the MLB's economic strategy would completely change if all documentation were to become public information. In other words, let us know where the money is, deal with us as partners in this, and we'll figure something out. And so what Denny is saying is this is by reveal by these great reporters for the Athletic and ESPN or whatever, and that the owner's proposal would be a sliding scale. In other words, the players that make the least, the majority of Major League players make $1 million or less, right? So if people can wrap their heads around that, the fact that $1 million for a guy to making at the top of his profession with an average career of 3 or 4 years is not outrageous by any means.
Eli, look, I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, and I don't think a lot of people are either, but I think you're missing the main point. Because of this crisis, millions and millions of North Americans are out of work. They're going broke. They're losing their homes to repossession, and they're talking about how they're going to divide the millions in baseball, as the owners and players
don't pick on the players again. I mean, that means you can pick on Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley and everybody else. We don't want to do that. The players made an agreement. They're going to live with the agreement. I don't think it's going to come down to where they think it's coming down right now, but I suspect that there's a little bit of room left. I'm surprised at Max Scherzer that he came out so strongly. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. Bauer, who was with either Tampa Bay or
Cincinnati
or Boston,
Reds.
He came out also, but yet he indicated that the most important thing that we should focus on are the fans. So it's nice to see one of those eight guys at least speak favorably about the people who pay all the bills. But the owners, they got themselves in a ditch here, and I don't know how they're going to solve it at this point in time other than, and the players come up with a good idea, let's play more than 100 games. Let's figure out some way to play more than 100 games, and then let's go from there and see what happens.
Yep. What they say about this proposal, you see, what they're doing is they're going to say, look, you low-salary guys, you know, the minimum is about 560. Most make less than a million. We're going to give you your prorated amount, which is about, if we play 40% of the games, 50% of the games, you'll get half your salary. Where they want to make it up, as you alluded to, Denny, was to take the $30 million guys and make them make a lot less. So here, use Garrett Cole, of course. He's slated to make $36 million this year. He would be making $18 million if it was a prorated system. But now they're saying he would only get about $8 million as far as that goes. Yes, I want to make sure Bob doesn't say thank you, Marvin Miller, again. Doing everything I can to avoid that phrase from coming into this conversation. But
thank
the point
you, Marvin
is,
Miller.
They are pitting the really high paid guys against the lower paid guys, which is classic dividing.
Yeah. But aren't you sick of the whole thing? Guys, aren't you sick of this whole thing?
We all agree on that. I'm with you, Bob. I said it last time, and I'm frankly surprised that you agreed with me, but I'm really glad that you did. And by the way, our guest on Monday, not to skip too far ahead, is Dick Trusewski. Had a wonderful conversation with Trixie the other night, and his thing was, what are they doing? This is just wait until you can get it right. I'll see you again in 2021. So long, everybody. Let's get it right, and let's keep the game the way
we remember it. Well, he gets it then, yeah. And the thing about it is, there's so much hypocrisy in all this stuff. So here comes the Australian Medical Association saying plans for fans at its National Rugby League matches are, quote, absurd and dangerous. You got these big, strong, tough guys with no helmets, banging heads, bleeding all over the place every match, getting concussions every match. But uh-oh, COVID-19, we can't play.
There's one other thing I want to add to this. The players had discussed, or the owners had discussed and proposed, for conversation's sakes, and I don't think this moved yet, but they proposed that the money that the players wind up being a little bit short on, whether it's $1 million or $1,000 or whatever it might be, the money could be paid over a number of years.
Yes, deferred payments.
Of that money. That's a good idea. That shows some progress, because they weren't moving anywhere with the kinds of things that Max, and I'm really surprised at Max. I mean, he's a great guy. I mean, he's soft. He's doesn't jump up and down.
I agree with him 100%. I don't disagree with a single word he said. I give him credit for saying it.
You got to sit down, though. You can't say, no, I'm not talking to anybody. He said he's not talking to anybody anymore.
He is saying if they will justify what they're saying by showing us where the money is, then that's a different story.
But Eli,
that's why they never agreed to a salary cap in baseball.
Eli, it's the same old story.
Eli, I went through this. I played a long time ago. It was the same object, same problem. They would never show us the books.
Yes.
They can't show us the books, because then we're going to want a piece of those books, and they're never, ever going to cross that bridge.
Okay, boys, now listen. These are just baseball players. They're highly paid professional athletes playing for multi-billionaire owners. Now, Denny stirred up a lot of people with his comment here the other day, his opinion, he has a right to it, that Governor Whitmer has done a great job in Michigan. So the conservative Detroit News does not support that, but the liberal Detroit Free Press does. So this piece is from Wednesday's Detroit Free Press.
Be careful about politics,
okay? The real world. This isn't politics. Listen to this.
Thank you.
One revelation to emerge from Detroit's bankruptcy 7 years ago was the extent of the city's dependence on tax receipts from the three casinos. The properties pumped more than $170 million a year into the municipal budget. And this was going on during the Great Recession, for goodness sake. The emergency manager at that time said, casino revenue is the single most stable source of revenue available to the city of Detroit. Without it, the city couldn't operate. So now, They have $0 that's been generated in wagering taxes since Governor Whitman closed all three casinos. It's totally upended Detroit's budget. And from canceled Tigers, Pistons, and Red Wings games, no auto show in Detroit this year, no conventions in Detroit, and fewer downtown office workers and visitors. Do you see what I'm going, where I'm going with this? This is going to be a nightmare, not for millionaires and billionaires, for the people of the city of Detroit. The city is going to be in another nightmare, and we wish Mayor Mike Duggan luck.
Let me add something.
What's this have to do with sports, though? I don't quite get that. Yeah,
well, lost revenue from the Tigers, the Red Wings, casinos, that type of gambling stuff. On sports.
I can understand that. But, Bob, there is stimulus bailout money coming for the city of Detroit. We don't know how much yet, but they maybe even got some of it already. But they're getting some big, big dollars to help them get through these times. So it's not going to be
that's coming from our government, right? Again. Yeah. Huh? That's coming from our government, the national government.
That's coming from D.C., yeah.
Okay, fine. And we now are already in this country running, I think it's now $23 trillion yes. budget okay. deficit. We're just going to print this money then,
put some perspective
Well, that's
here.
Another
okay.
subject.
I have some perspective here. I agree with all of that, that it's money lost, and that's why sports will come back, because it's about money and they're businessmen, and I can't blame them. It's about money. But, you know, we still have not solved the virus. Right. It could be worse in October and September than it is right now. Other countries have proven that there are ways to control it with social distancing and wearing masks, etc. I understand that people want to get out. They got coronavirus, their fatigue. And you see the pictures of people at beaches and the people in Missouri there and all that. So there's going to be another wave of it. We've decided that we're just going to cull the herd here. We're going to lose the people we're going to lose. We're going to charge out there, and we're going to start playing ball and going to restaurants, doing all those that are willing to. And we're going to cull the herd of more old people, more people of color, as they say, that live too close together, or are people who have immunity problems. So there's going to be a lot more losses that'll happen in sports also. And that's, I guess, the price that we pay. But they're going to come back, and it's going to be ugly, I think. Hopefully not. But what happens in baseball when a player gets the virus and then two or three or four others do it? It's inevitable it's going to happen.
Then they recover because they're young athletes in the prime of life.
Okay, but maybe Dusty Baker
won't. If they have any symptoms, by the way.
Well, listen, I agree with that. But that's what's going to happen, and that's the danger that we have, because we have not really – and I agree, the economy is important. I'm so glad people are going back to work so they can protect my 401k. Thank you very much while I hide in Bloomfield Hills.
Well, if you got to hide, that's a beautiful place to hide. And I would also say this, Eli, because you asked me, what does this have to do with sports? Come on. This was the year, wasn't it, this fall, that Michigan was finally going to open gambling up to the public, legal gambling?
Yeah, sure.
How much money are the casinos losing on that? There are no games to bet on.
Yeah, and Vegas is going to open up pretty soon, and we'll see what happens. But
yeah, Vegas opens up. Part of Vegas opens up next week.
Yeah, the problem with a lot of it is it's not an individual decision, because you can affect other people around you. Bottom line, it isn't like you're only suffering when you suffer. You can cause many other people to suffer by spreading it around.
And okay, I'll give you my prediction. As of tomorrow, when they make this other proposal that the players are getting ready to make, I think you'll see some movement next week, because they can't wait much longer. If they wait another 2, 3, 4 weeks, they'll never throw in a spring training, and they'll never get 82 games in. So it's time for somebody to poop and get off the pot and let's go.
I've been asking you guys this question, Brandon. I want to include you here too. Since day one of this, when this started, do you miss sports and watching it on TV or going to games?
I do.
Of course.
Sure. Sure. I miss it. I miss it. I mean, I always felt there was too much of it, but I can't control that. I mean, if you're in our business and you're trying to at least pretend that you're on top of everything that's going on, it's overwhelming. With four leagues playing at once, I mean, in the spring, you got the NHL, the NBA, MLB, you got the football offseason. Who can keep up with all of it? So, no, I miss it, but you know what? It's all going to get, especially in college, it's all going to get pared back. There's going to be teams that go out of business. There's going to be schools that won't play football anymore. There's going to be – the coaches' salaries are going to come down. It's a whole reset. It's a whole reset of the entire sports world. But
if I can answer my own question, last night, Wednesday night, I watched – I think it was the 75-76 great NBA playoff series between Boston Celtics and the Phoenix Suns.
Oh, great series.
And it was amazing. It was so cool to see again. And Collins, at least in the first half, there was my dog, Eli. Collins, at least in the first half, along with John Havlicek, just ate Phoenix up. I really enjoyed watching this just to see how the game was back then as opposed to today. No three-point circle, of course, on the court. Brent Musburger looked so young, and Rick Barry was his color commentator with some kind of weird, you know, Nehru little powder blue coat on and some huge piece of jewelry. I enjoyed that. Do I miss current sports? I'm okay. I'm fine.
Yeah, you know, well, wait a second. You mean you're not excited to see players with no home court advantage and no fans play in Disney World, the happiest place in the world?
I'm not.
Everybody's on the same court, and they're gonna. It's gonna be like one of those little high school tournaments, you know, where the girls play volleyball and Team A versus Team B, and they sit out and they eat some food along the side, and they go back and play again. That's what it's gonna look like, and I just can't imagine accepting this as real.
Okay, so I want to add something to this because it made some noise the last couple of days. So with this going on, as you describe it, what the networks are planning to do is use a tape delay on the telecast because there won't be any fan noise, nothing to drown anything out, and you'll hear the players on the court speak as they usually do with profanity and all kinds of profanity. Oh my goodness, we can't have that. Now, do you remember when we were kids growing up, a real dirty word was, you never really heard it, damn. That was, well, he said, sure. Damn, yeah. That was shocking. Times have changed since then a lot. And now every six-year-old knows every four-letter word and swear word in the book. I don't you think it's time to get over this? If somebody drops an F-bomb or an SH-bomb on the court during a game and we
of course.
Hear it, so what? So what? Let's move on. Let it go.
Yeah, well.
One other thing about the teams, I'm defending the owners right now to some degree. They have always the prerogative of adding two teams to Major League Baseball. They're talking to people right now about bringing two new teams in for an expansion. Each team will play almost, each team will pay almost $1 billion each to join the American League or the National League. So they got lots of ways to stay out of trouble. They've done it in the past. They'll do it again. They got all kinds of programs that they can fall back on. So nobody should feel sorry for them at this point in time. Let's just start playing ball here in the next month or so.
I think the players are okay with the safety. Those that have immune problems won't play. Each player is going to have to be quarantined for a couple of weeks. The bottom line in all of it is, oh, and I'm not supposed to say bottom line to where that's your thing, Denny. You had a great letter on that this week. But the bottom line is you can't keep contact sports and players with camaraderie safe. You can't do it with a bunch of Clorox wipes. Okay. Players are going to get together. They're going to talk to each other. They're going to hang out. It's impossible to make it safe. It's just how unsafe will we tolerate it? And again,
but you can drink the Clorox.
You can inject it.
Oh, it's physically possible. After you do, we don't know what's going to happen, but it is what it is.
But I look, the best case scenario is it all goes beautifully and a couple of people may come down with the virus, maybe some older people, but they turn out okay. The worst case scenario is one of these seasons starts, somebody gets infected, suffers some type of life-altering health effect, or dies. How much of that can we tolerate? Again,
yeah, you're right. You're totally right, which is why you and I have been saying, see you next year, boys. When this is going to be over.
But that's not reality. But Bob, that's not reality. Reality is they're going to play because the reality is they're going to play because they're businesses and they have to. Even college football will be, I guarantee you, college football will happen this year no matter what Mark Schlissel happened to say the other day. Don't forget, Mark Schlissel is the same guy when he got hired, and this is the president of Michigan. I have great respect for him. He came from Brown, where he de-emphasized sports, and they said, oh, no, Mark Schlissel is going to come in. He's going to de-emphasize football. Michigan's got no chance. First thing he did was he hired a coach at $9 million a year. So I'm not too concerned about what he said about.
Well, is it what's obvious? Obviously, this guy doesn't know much about football, as you say, but he does. He's a very bright guy. He understands results. He looked at the results of the Michigan-Ohio State game for the last number of years and said, you know what? We're not going to play football this year.
He's an expert in immunology also. So that's another thing to respect.
I know that. Okay. He's a medical doctor. Anyway, so Michigan State announced this week that kids are going to be back on campus as normal for the fall session. So since they did that, you would think that Schlissel's got to follow up at Michigan, as well as the Michigan, Central, Eastern, Western, so on and so forth. So that means the coast now is clear for football to resume. Right? Am I right?
Which president just recently announced that we're going to not have people in the seats? Was that a state or was that Michigan?
That's Dr. Schlissel, who said if kids are not back living on campus, there will be no football. But as I said, Michigan State kids will be back living on campus. And so I would think there would be football at MSU. Michigan's got to follow suit.
And you can argue, as some athletic directors are, hey, the kids are safer on campus than they are at home. Is that true? I don't know. Maybe so. Interesting, we talked about the F-bombs dropped. I want to talk about that in a moment. But first, I want to remind you that David Hall and Hall Financial really care about this community. That's why they're working from home around the clock to help people save some money. Great time to refinance. If you haven't in the last year, you can lower your monthly payments. The rates are amazing. Keep some money in your pocket. By refinancing, you probably skip up to two payments. Don't worry about the coronavirus in terms of appraising your house. Their appraisers can drive by and make a fair appraisal that way. Your Hall's Financial Services, the fastest in the business. They have nearly 1,500 five-star reviews right here from Michigan homeowners. So go to the webpage or get started by calling 248-308-5000. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, more personal attention. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. So
can I, Eli, can I mention another note about Michigan football here?
Go right ahead.
Okay, fine. I was really surprised by what I saw in the papers this week. Everybody reported that Jim Harbaugh was said to be ecstatic, leaping around, jumping for joy when he landed linebacker Jaden Hood as a recruit. I'm trying to figure out why. Right. He's the 191st ranked prospect overall. To get him, Harbaugh had to beat Kentucky, Minnesota, Louisville, and South Carolina. No, not Alabama, Clemson, or Ohio State. So this guy has already got a teammate playing at Michigan from Fort Lauderdale. I mean, we don't talk a lot about recruiting because you can't put too much emphasis on it. Mark D'Antonio made big stars out of two stars and been a lot of five stars who didn't make it at Michigan. But is this what it's come to for Harbaugh? As Ohio State is kicking his ass in recruiting along with the aforementioned universities, this is what it's come to? That he's excited about this kid? And he had to beat Kentucky, Minnesota, and Louisville on him?
He's the 48th ranked player in Florida. So he's barely in the top 50 in Florida. Maybe Jim Harbaugh sees he fits perfect into my program. That's just what I want. He's the kind of guy. Now, you mentioned about was the NBA, they're gonna pre-tape to maybe cut out all the cursing and everything. So I'm watching the match with Mickelson and a Tiger and Brady and Peyton Manning the other day. And my wife says to me, you see what good, how polite they are. They're not cursing. You know, you drop too many F-bombs around the house. I can't imagine you on the golf course. Look at these guys, how well they're behaving. I go, Patty, they got microphones on. They're not going to be their regular selves. There's no such thing as reality television. Okay. Yeah. Reality television isn't real because there's a camera there and there's microphones there. Now, by the same token, if we're ready to move on for a moment, I'm really glad to see that they're going to do more of these matches and that Mickelson wants to make it an annual event. And I would love that. The best line during the whole thing that explained it all was when Bill Murray said, "They look human," which is exactly what you want to see. Tom Brady looking human. He looks so much more human. I liked him so much more watching him play golf than I ever have watching him play football. I respect him at football, but when he gets on the tee and he's so nervous, he hits six straight crappy tee shots in a row. I go, that's me. I'm just like Tom.
You're not going to have the kind of entertainment every time, and you're going to have more like the entertainment of the first match 2 or 3 weeks ago than you are of this kind of high-quality entertainment. You know, these guys are really professional on stage guys, too. The guys we're talking about Tom and Peyton Manning. So, I mean, the bottom line is these two guys are pros. They know what they're doing. They use these.
There's more guys.
Let me finish. I've sat here for 10 minutes and listened to you guys bullshit. Okay. And let me pardon my French. But
we've already agreed we're going to let those words pass now.
These guys are entertainers. They've used these lines a million ways at a million different facilities and shows and promotions. So, but they are good. And it's really tough to find two guys that are that effective and keep your
you know, attention for what, 3.5-4 hours.
But this
they
is,
were
but,
they were terrific. I that was them again. I'd watch it, but I don't know if there's anybody else that has that kind of value.
Good point. But they figured it out. The first time was Tiger and Phil, and it was a bomb because
terrible.
They had technical problems, and they're playing to win, and they're not talking to each other. And then the next one we saw with Fowler and Dustin Johnson was boring as hell terrible. Because the personalities were boring as hell. This was different. You got Tiger Woods acting like a real guy. You got Phil Mickelson. The instruction, him explaining to Tom Brady how he's going to hit this pitch shot as a golfer, I loved it. I couldn't get more of it. I would love to see them do this in a match once a week where they go around the course explaining why I'm going to hit this shot, what I'm thinking here, how I measure the wind. This is what golfers think of in every shot because that's the beauty of the game. Each shot is different with 1,000 factors. No two lies are the same. The ball's not in the same position. Your feet aren't in the same position. The grass is higher and lower. There's wind. There's trees. It's a fascinating thing to see. Phil Mickelson's thought process was fascinating. So they're going to get Denny. Denny, you're shaking your head. I see.
Contrary to what you think, it's like talking about your sex life. We don't want to hear about it.
I agree with Denny. And I'm with Denny 100% on this.
And here's the other thing.
It's not for you, Bob.
I played a lot of golf, a ton of golf. You know I have. And I'll tell you, I don't enjoy telling a guy, well, the ball's going to break this way or go this way. The grass is bent this way. If it's dark grass, it goes uphill. We already know that. I mean, we played enough. But here's my point. There is no possible way, and I agree with Bob, there is no way you can create the excitement next time.
It's why
impossible.
Not?
Because you can't find there, these two done guys.
Yes, you
again.
Can. Time out. Tony Romo. Ooh. Tony Ooh. Romo. Michael Jordan. Seth Curry. These are big stars who play golf, who have personalities.
But we already have that celebrity event in California every year. All those guys play anyway. We're used to watching them.
Okay, fine.
Okay, here's what I want to say about this. I mentioned on the last show, since you brought up the topic of the last show, Phil saying he was actually nervous on the first hole. Made sense to me because I said so many non-golf fans, mainly football fans, would be tuned in to see how things were going. The ratings are in, boys. Did you see them?
Yes.
No.
Terrific.
Ratings, the match on Sunday drew an average of 5.8 million viewers. This event was thus the most watched golf telecast
in the
history of cable television, beating the first round of, get this, the 2010 Masters on ESPN, which drew a million fewer.
Bob, now go back and look up real quick 2 or 3 weeks ago when they played. See what that number is. It'll be so small you won't be able to read
it. Yeah, I know. It's a problem. Look, Eli and I have discussed this before, and he is unusual. And he's a golf wacko. He keeps saying, I'm not a golf fan. False. I watch every round of every major. I love watching the PGA Tour. I just don't want to play golf. Okay? So the thing about it is, I'm trying to watch a golf tournament, and after every shot, here's little Peter Costas coming on. Well, let's analyze that swing. I don't want to see it, Peter. I'm not that serious about golf. Now, Eli, you do. But how many people are in your boat?
Right.
How many That's people want to see that?
I mean, the biz hub, what do you call it? The Konica Minolta biz hub swing, blah, blah, blah.
I don't know.
I find it fascinating. And you don't have to pay attention to that. Just like when you listen to a baseball or a football game, how many times does a color announcer go into some explanation about, well, he peeled off and he scraped off and the outside linebacker bit for the this and that and they're playing cover two? You can tune that out and still just watch the game.
How many boys grew up playing football? As opposed to golf in this country, we all played football. We all know what they're talking about.
I don't know if that's true, but most of us know when a guy goes out for a pass, he's going to catch a pass. He's going to try to catch a pass. In golf, there's so many little things going on before as you stand over the ball and you get ready to hit. Yeah. I got to have this stiff. I got to have this stiff. I got to have this moved. I got to make sure my hands are here. I mean, it's a very difficult, complicated game, and to play it at their level. And the entertainment value they had Sunday, and I agree 100%, it's the best I've seen in a long time.
Listen, you can enjoy the game. I'll give you an example and hope she's not listening in the other room. my wife loves football and golf.
You gutless little bastard.
I think beyond the fact that 10 yards is
Patty, come on up for a minute, okay?
I think beyond the fact that it's 10 yards for a first down, and you have three plays, and if you have, and you can punt on the fourth down, Other than that, I don't know how deep she understands the game, but she loves football and she loves Brady. The same with golf. You don't understand, but you don't care about the wind and you don't care about the line. You like watching the guys hit the ball. You can enjoy. This is the beauty of sports. It's easily understandable. You can be an ignoramus, not that I'm referring to you or my wife in that terms, and enjoy the game, or you can be a technical wizard who's studied the game all your life and enjoy. That's the beauty of sports. So the Mickelson-Tiger thing was tremendously entertaining to a number of people, and we enjoyed it in different ways. But the main thing is they were humanized in the golf game. They were also competitive. They were funny, entertaining, and the trash talking. What happens when four guys play golf? There's a book I would suggest you all read. It's called Golf in the Kingdom, written by about golf in Ireland, I think it was, or England. It was written years ago. Oh. And the bottom line is that golf is men loving men, is what he said. It's a strange thing, men loving men. But you go out on a Sunday or Saturday with your four buddies, and you say, the women aren't here, it's just us, and it's a wonderful camaraderie type of thing. And when Mickelson and Tiger are playing for the Masters, it's a whole different dynamic. They're into their own thing with their own caddy. This was the way we play it. Four guys.
You're neglecting to mention what you just said, and that is, anytime there's a camera or a microphone there, people are not themselves. I would love to have seen those four guys play Sunday without them knowing were being recorded.
That's never going to happen. It's as close as you can be to what it's like when four guys go, except the four guys happen to be four of the biggest sports personalities of all time and two of the greatest golfers in the history of the game. It made it playing it the way guys play.
But
very cool.
The excitement value is no worse than it is at a World Series game, at a NBA championship game, at an NHL, even the hockey when they have
a lot less than
championship.
That.
I'm talking about the excitement value. People will tune in for a match. People will tune in to see Phil and Tiger play. They're not going to tune in for the other guys. They just aren't.
But the guys are the person.
Hey, fellas, geez, I hope that we're not putting our listeners to sleep with 20 minutes on golf here. Can we move on to a quick story you've both been very outspoken about? Like to hear what you say about this in case people didn't see it.
Can I finish the golf thing before?
No, because you're going to go on 15 more minutes.
No. I'm going to, because Denny's talking about the competitive nature. Right. I don't know if I've told this story or not, but the Tigers won the World Series in 84. And in spring training in 85, I went out to play golf with Kirk Gibson because he was living in a condo.
Happy birthday to Gibby on Thursday. Did you know that? Yeah. Today's his birthday.
Well, you better wish my daughter a happy birthday, too.
We just
Michelle.
Did, Danny. Wake
Michelle.
Up. We just did.
Anyway,
we come down
to the last hole, and Gibby and I are tied. And I'm thinking to myself, look at this. I'm going to beat a World Series champion at nine holes. Maybe I'll tell the world about it. He proceeds to sink about a 60-foot putt that snakes around and goes in, and he starts jumping up and down, pumping his fist, just like he'd Mary Schrader's picture on the front page. And I said to myself, he just beat a sports reporter with no athletic ability, but that's the competitive nature. And that's why you love guys like Kirk Gibson. You love guys like Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson, Brady and Peyton. Brady so much wanted to win, he couldn't play because it's not his game. Anyway, go ahead, Bob. I'm sorry.
Okay, fine. Now here's your mush softball, you two, to knock out of the park. I'm going to mention it to you briefly and you take it away. This week, the Michigan House of Representatives approved name, image, and likeness plans for college athletes. A bipartisan plan was introduced in the Michigan State House. It easily passed on Wednesday of this week, and the bill now goes to the Senate, which is expected to sign it and pass it as well. So your favorite players from Michigan and Michigan State, if they're any good, can now make a lot of money on the side signing autograph pictures or whatever.
Terrific.
Huge. It's going to be a huge failure, and it's going to prove the imbalance in sports.
What do you mean it's going to be a huge failure?
Your kids are going to finally get paid, Eli. Let me ask you, here's an example, all right? Do you think that the Michigan quarterback has the same advantage as the offensive center, as Cesar Ruiz was a center for Michigan, drafted in the first round? Would anybody pay him anything to sell cars? No, because nobody knows who he is. So
I don't care.
And plus, these players have got no agent, not allowed agents. There's no system set up to allow them to do this equitably and fairly. It's going to be a huge failure.
eventually they're going to have agents and or attorneys to represent them. Eventually that's going to happen because you just can't throw the kids out there as bad meat. I mean, these kids are walking into a world they've never, ever saw before.
Right.
And the sharks out there will eat them alive.
Right.
And, so they will measure everything. Hopefully they'll take their time. And maybe the school will set something up that they can talk to the school and get a little bit of advice. But you know what? It's about time. We've been talking about this. You've agreed with me over the years that the players should be paid
somehow. Of course, of course.
And it's time. If this is the start, if this is the first step, let's take the first step and
that's
then
fine.
Something better will happen.
It's going to fail, but it'll lead to something better. That's right. It'll be totally unequal.
Okay, I want you to think about this, Eli, based upon what you just said. You live in a lovely area of suburban Detroit. Everybody knows Bloomfield Hills, gorgeous up there. You ever sat down in your nice house, looked at the guy's house across the street and think, you know, I wonder if that guy makes more money than I do. What? He made how much last year? We make decisions about our lives that eventually pertain to money. I'm not sure a lot of these guys, the second string left guard, they're not going to look at the quarterbacks and say, well, he made all this money in endorsements. I want it too. It's just the way life is. You don't make as much money as somebody else. Live with it. Deal with it.
Well, you're right, because the quarterbacks, the Tom Brady's and guys like this, when they're having a good year, they go out and buy their lineman a wristwatch or a car or shirts or clothes. So, you know, everybody's going to get a little trickle down, as Mr. Reagan used to say. And a little trickle down for these kids means a great deal.
I can't wait till the quarterback makes more than the coach. And
it's funny, Denny, you know, for men our age, and a lot of guys in the audience can relate, we men our age, we kind of have a trickle-down effect too, don't we, time we stand over the potty?
Yeah.
When we stand over the potty.
Well, some of us sit down.
Wow.
Those that respect the women in the household sit down.
Hey, yeah, not only that, but it's tough to stay straight up for a long time now.
Okay, I want to talk about a little bit about our guests coming up. We didn't mention it at the beginning of the show, but we got Tom Nowatzki coming up. Now, Tom Nowatzki was an All-American fullback at Indiana.
One of my favorite people.
Drafted 11th by the Lions in 1965, had five great years here. He is the only very few ex-Lions ever play in a Super Bowl or win a Super Bowl. I was trying to think of how many have won a Super Bowl. Eddie Murray won a Super Bowl after he left with Dallas. I know Ray Crockett, I believe, won a couple. I discussed that with Brandon before. I know he played for the Broncos back in the Elway era. But no question, Tom Nowatzki was released by the Lions in 1969 after five good years here. He's only 27, went to the Colts and scored a touchdown in Super Bowl V, and he wears that ring every single day.
I swear he never takes it off.
I don't know. I don't see you wearing your 68 series ring today, Denny, and I don't want to know what happened to that.
Well, Mrs.
point.
McLean put it in a safety deposit box at the bank, and it's been there for, I think, 20 years.
Something like that is just so special. Been I don't blame Tom Nowatzki at all for wearing his Super Bowl ring every day.
Couple other Lions that won that come to mind after they left Detroit was obviously Kyle Van Noy.
Yes, yes.
What about Charlie Batch?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was with Pittsburgh. Yeah, he was back up to
Big Ben, right? Yeah. And Willie Green.
But did any of these former players score the game-tying touchdown? No, just Tom Nowatzki. We'll talk to Tom a little bit later. Hey, for nearly 20 years, Luke Nowacki has worked with individuals, families, business owners, people like you and me to help gain clarity about where you are in your financial situation. How can I help you gain some peace of mind in the future? Let's develop a plan to make sure that you have what you need when you need it. He works at Pinnacle Wealth Strategies, and you should call him at 248-663-4748. Luke will help you create a plan to reach your financial goals, answering all your questions free of charge with a complimentary consultation. So in these difficult times, be ready, okay? Call Luke at Pinnacle Wealth Strategies at 248-663-4748. Advisory services offered through Royal Alliance Associates, Inc. Other marketing names, product service reference here, independent of Royal Alliance Associates. You are listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. I'd like to thank a few people who have sent us donations. Three, in fact, have done the monthly plan. So happy, Brian Fusen, John Eckleberry, Richard Contreras, between $4 and $10 a month. That's going to help. I don't think we're going to meet our expenses this month, but we certainly appreciate it. After that initial start, we still have people donating to us. Hey, we have 15,000 regular listeners. If a third of you gave us a dollar a month, we'd be able to meet our expenses. So please, I don't care how little it is. If you want to help us out, just go to the donation page on No Filter Sports Show and No Filter Sports Podcast and help us out. Thank you to all those who have.
Well, you should call your fellow University of Michigan graduate, Stephen Ross, up and ask him to be a contributor to the show. The multi-billionaire says there's going to be an NFL season this year. There will be. Sure. He's a brilliant guy. We know that. U of M's terrific school of business, even named after him. He put up so much dough. So Ross is thinking to himself, why sit there with a beautiful empty stadium just waiting for football that may never come? So it's been announced in the last couple of days that Ross's Miami Dolphins will use Hard Rock Stadium as a drive-in movie theater, which will hold a maximum of 230 cars.
Wait a minute.
But I want to go.
Inside the stadium?
Yes. Yes.
What's going to happen?
Drive
to the
those
field?
Babies, I guess, right inside the stadium. They got a screen set up for you. Obviously, they'll protect the field. Yeah.
There's no money. How about in that? My goodness.
I think it's a great idea.
Can't hurt. Hey, so can I try a new little feature here? Let's take a look, because remember we talked the other day when May 25th, our show on Monday, and I remember that golden day for my sports youth where I saved up money to go see the second Ali Liston fight. So I said, well, let's look up this day in sports and see. So
was that the thriller in Manila?
No. The thrills, okay. That was 10 years later. That was 75 when Ali fought Frazier for the third time. It was a thrill in Manila. A year after the Rumble in the Jungle, when he took the title back from George Foreman.
Yes, because Sharon and I went to that fight. We had a great time.
Do you guys ever meet Joe Frazier?
Wait a minute. Time out. You were in Manila?
Yes.
You went to Manila?
Yes, ma'am.
What the hell were you doing in Manila?
Somebody gave me airline tickets.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You went to that fight?
Yeah, sure.
You went
did.
To Manila? Ale Bumbaye is what they said? Wow.
When I told Sharon, I said, we're going to Manila. She says, I don't like vanilla.
I was just going to ask you, I just want to say this one thing about Joe Frazier. I interviewed him in New York a number of times. I always felt so sorry for him. He was such a nice man
and a
classy guy. And Ali did his best to try to make him look like some kind of a clown, which I assure you, Joe Frazier was not.
What did he call him? He called Liston the gorilla,
yeah,
which would not work in this day and age. No, he called Liston the big ugly bear. Did he call Frazier the gorilla? I don't know what he called him, but he was very nasty. He called him an Uncle Tom because...
Yeah, I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But let me tell
you... Ali did some very cruel things, but he did the floor.
Let me give you a 30-second story on Ali. I'm coming out of the commissioner's office. I just been suspended. And the whole world is around us as we're coming off the elevator. And the first and second guy we run into outside the commissioner's office is Ali and Howard Cosell, the two of them standing there. And Ali grabbed me, put his arms around me and said, I didn't realize you were so little.
And Cosell said, and it's you, Dennis Dale McClain.
So I decided to take 3 days, since this is the 20th, I took the 27th, the 28th, and the 29th. I said, what happened on sports in this day? So I go back, and there's some interesting, 1951, Willie Mays hit his first major league home run. He'd started out 0-for-12. Look up to number 60. I remember this happening, where manager Paul Richards for the Orioles devised the first oversized catcher's mitt for catcher Clint Coyle. Yeah. Why was that? Yeah. What was it
Knuckle
for?
Knuckleball.
Exactly.
Of course it was, because Hoyt Wilhelm was on that staff. And I was at an exhibition game in 1961, and I saw Wilhelm pitch from right behind the plate. He made it. You know Joe Ginsburg,
yes,
play with the Tigers, as did Paul Richards, of course. Joe was a great guy. So he made it for Joe and for Gus Triantos, who also went on to play for the Tigers. And my dad's sitting next to me in the front row. Every time Ginsburg comes to the backstop, he's like right next to us, 2 feet away. Yeah. My dad starts yelling, get a stick and kill it, Joe. Get a stick and kill it. And Ginsburg looks up at my dad and just starts laughing his butt off.
When I met Joe Ginsburg.
Gus Triantos, by the way, was my first major league game I pitched. He caught it.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
I met Joe Ginsburg, and I said, I thought I'd give him a compliment, but he didn't take it the way. I said, Joe, you are the greatest Jewish backup catcher in history. He didn't like that. I think he thought he was a starter. You
know, there was also Norm Sherry. I mean, I know he started the Dodgers, but there. Yeah,
so
we had Larry on our club too. He was what would be the right? He kind of guy that always wore an overcoat and a hat. Yeah. I'm not saying anymore.
Okay.
And by the way, Eli, I got to correct this right now, and I'm going to hip our listeners who may not know about him. The most famous backup catcher ever backed up on the New York Yankees several years, Bill Dickey, was, of course, Mo Berg. Of the most brilliant men ever to play
Major League
Baseball, and was a spy for us before the war began in 41. There are a couple great books out on him. Fantastic reads.
All right. As you like to say, Bob, let's move on back to our feature today, which is This Day in Sports. This day in 1965, Dick Allen hit a 529-foot home run at a Connie Mack Stadium. Not only don't I remember that, or vaguely so, but Connie Mack Stadium, I mean, that's long gone. I think Brandon looked up, it was open in 1909 and finally shut down in 1970. And back then, Wrigley Field was built in 08. Fenway Park was built, I think, about then. So, but those two are still around, amazingly enough.
We played an exhibition game there in the middle 60s, our Tigers against Philadelphia. Remember, they used to play the Little League games. You go in there for one day, you play, and they'd raise 50, 60 grand. Anyway, we went in there and played, and Richie was the first hitter of the ball game. He was only going to play just one inning. And Lord, he went up, and I wish I could remember who the pitcher was, because he hit it straight away center field, and the ball could not bend any higher than his ankles. He hit the ball so hard off the ground, you wouldn't imagine a ball could get out of a ballpark that quick.
He should be a Hall of Famer, I think, but we'll see.
Remember back in those days, though, weight training was a no-no because they thought it would recharge your coordination, so on and so forth. These guys like Lance Parrish and Brian Downing came along and changed the game. Now, if he had Richie Allen ever worked out with weights, how strong do you think he would have been then?
Oh, boy.
Let's move on here. Larry Bird beat out Magic Johnson on this day for the Rookie of the Year title in 1980. Remember this one in 81, Lenny Randle blow a slow roller foul, and the umpire said, no, you can't do that.
I played with him, too.
And so
that was that Rookie of the Year thing you mentioned, that was Irvin's Rookie of the Year, as you said. That season, Kareem got hurt. Yep. And Irvin put up, 42 and 17 rebounds in the last game of the NBA Finals to win the world championship, and Larry Bird was more valuable?
Interesting that was on May 15th, the NBA Finals, and now they don't end for over a month after that. 1957, the National League approved the Dodgers and Giants' move to the West Coast. That was a big deal. And I put this one from May 26th. I saw a replay on the other day on SportsCenter where the ball famously by Carlos Martinez hit Jose Canseco in the head for a home run. The reason I put that in is because 3 days later, Brandon Playet, this happened to Jose Canseco too.
Well, you hear the ovation for Jose Canseco making his major league debut on the mound.
Valentin swings away. DeCenzo in right with the catch. Hatcher swings away, lofts a fly ball, left center field. Holtz with the catch, and that will retire the side. Sox pick up three in the bottom half of the eighth inning off Jose Canseco, and they will take a seemingly safe 15-1 lead.
He had damaged his arm pitching that night, and it cost him a little trip.
We've been trying to tell Denny this for such a long time on this program, Eli. Pitching's not that hard. It's not that hard. Even Canseco goes in and retires the side.
Two more. Lastly,
15-1.
two more. Barry Bonds hit his 715.
Is this going to end at some point?
On this day. And lastly, in 2017, Tiger Woods arrested and charged with driving under the influence. We'll never forget the mugshot we saw that day.
Well, you got those two guys in the same clip because the other guy used a lot of program enhancing drugs.
That's right. That's right.
So we've got, anyway, obviously the mailbag and our great guest, Tom Nowotzki, coming up. A couple more stories, if I may. Eli, I'm shocked that you have not mentioned this yet. There's your boy. A little bit of lunacy here from Mike Tyson. He's expected to be offered a contract by, get this, Bare Knuckles Fighting Championship.
He turned it down.
Has he already turned it down?
He turned it down. Wait, but he's going to fight. He's going to fight Shannon Briggs. He's going to come back and fight Shannon Briggs.
But they have bare knuckle fighting professional. I mean, guys like that are going to get hurt.
I think they're going to wrestle, aren't they?
No. They're going to box. This is the absurdity of it all.
He's going to get hurt.
a 53-year-old man should not be boxing.
Right.
And to see him and Shannon, but it's going to be an exhibition. Maybe they'll wear headgear. I don't know.
That's crazy. How about your beloved Pistons, Eli? They're opening a search this week for a new GM. Ed Stefanski has been leading the front office with the title of special advisor. They have no president of basketball operations or GM, but Stefanski has a couple other guys working for him underneath him. Now, sources told the Detroit News, get this, Stefanski would remain in a supervisory role with the new GM reporting to him. You don't run a basketball team this way. It's amazing to me what's going on with those guys. Go ahead.
Well, GMs always report to the owners. I mean, anytime.
No. This guy's not an owner. The GM is going to report to the special aide or team president.
Okay.
Of course they have to report to the owner.
I don't
you don't do it with one guy. When Joe Dumars ran the Detroit Pistons, like Stevie Eisenman with the Wings right now, one voice, one guy.
Except you still have to go to the owner and approve everything.
That's true. But
so
you
it's just one more
channels.
Layer.
The political intrigue is going to be amazing.
I disagree. By the way, we need to say goodbye to our radio listeners at WCWA in Toledo, WDFN in Detroit. You have been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Okay, let's get to the bag. We got Tom Nowotzki coming up in a few minutes. What do you got in the bag?
All right. We go to the mailbag. Eli, this is going to be the high point of your day because
we don't
have a lot of the mailbag today. Right. Eli,
if you eliminate the people that hate you, the bag is very light.
you know how strong our podcast download numbers would be if I weren't on this show, if I just do what I'm supposed to be doing, enjoying life here in paradise. All right, here's the mailbag, right?
You never want to test it, Bob.
Eli, fans are almost rioting in the streets after our mailbag Monday. You guys can tweet us at Eli Zerrett, at MU2Denny, or at Bob Page Sports. The not-awful mailbag tweets, I play a drinking game while listening to your show. Each time Eli makes an insulting comment about the mailbag, I down a shot. Needless to say, I passed out before the mailbag was even done as Eli battered our mailbag on Memorial Day, no less.
Good
Jimmy Lyons adds to that. Nothing gets Eli more fired up than the mailbag. Maybe I should actually open your show.
I am happy. I am gay.
Just to tease Eli. Ed Klee, I really think Eli's jealous of the mailbag. And Jeff the Alaskan added last week, please mention to Eli that the mailbag is the greatest part of the show, according to we, the listener constituents.
Oh, jeez.
All right, Danny, here's one for you, buddy.
All right, buddy.
For me, at least, the tremendous suspense started growing when Tiger Mike 1975, big fan of the show, tweeted me on Tuesday afternoon. And he wrote, "Is the topic of baseball cards has come up on the show recently. We got one to watch now. Denny's 1965 Topps rookie card, graded PSA mint condition, is up for auction on eBay. Only 30 exist of these cards, graded PSA 9 or higher, with only 3 perfect 10s. So that at that point, the top bid Tuesday was $126.50. When it closed Wednesday night, your rookie card was sold for $615.
Oh, my God.
Have you ever seen one go that high?
No, I haven't. I've seen them go for, you know, right around 100, depending upon what kind of an auction it is, but never that kind of a number.
Yeah, it's interesting. So now I want to ask you this. You came up at the end of 63. Yeah. Tigers gave you 3 starts, pitched pretty well. You went 2-1. In 64, you started 16 games for the Tigers, appeared in 19. You were 4-5. Why is 1965 your rookie card?
That makes no sense. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah. The 64 was supposed to be, and I don't know what happened to him because I come up late in 63. Remember that? I didn't get there till September. And then they got some kind of a rotating date, and I don't know how they figure it up. But I don't think 65 is the rookie card, is it?
No, it shouldn't be. It should be.
That's what they say on the internet.
Well,
no, unless you didn't pitch enough
64.
Games.
Yeah, I'll check on it. Yeah.
Sounds like pitching enough games to qualify for the
rookie. All right, so David Jones wants to pay tribute to Mr. Z today. And he writes, on your Thursday, May 21st show, I really appreciated Eli's Andy Rooney impression on Printer Ink. X amount of dollars for a cartridge breaks down to so much per sheet, followed by blubbering outrage. I'm glad to see the 60 Minutes curmudgeon spirit, that would be you, Eli, is still alive.
Now, I can't do imitations, but Andy Rooney would say, this is a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Now, the piece of paper costs less than a penny. But look at what's on the paper. do you believe that the ink on the paper costs 15 times more? How does this happen?
I still miss him. I met him at a party in New York one night. Very nice guy. Little tiny guy. He was married to a gal who was like 6'1". Very funny.
Yeah, so, what I liked best about him was he had eyebrows about 6 inches long.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
They were
I really miss him. I really miss him. Keep up the good work, guys. Loved the Tom Brookins interview from Tom Bell in Chicago. Website submissions. You can email us at asknofilter@gmail.com. Haven't heard from Solid Contact before, who says Tom Brookins should have gotten a shot to manage. Sick of being the Minnesota Twins East. I would think Tiger fans would be lucky to be the Minnesota Twins anything. The franchise is
yeah, this year it's going to be tough.
Yeah.
You know, I thought about that. They hired Ausmus over Tommy. You know, a lot of, and Tommy's so low key, but a lot of great managers are very low key.
So was Ausmus, though.
Yeah, you're right. He was. And I don't think Tommy would have been frightened of Justin Verlander the way
I don't
Ausmus
either.
Was.
Tommy would have stood up for himself.
You can also call a Texas. The number is 760-89-BALLS. As Eli mentioned earlier, Phil said, Denny's new crutch, the bottom line is, he said it 12 times in the last two episodes.
I've been saying it for 50 years.
Yeah, you and Vitel use that line incessantly.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Dick Vitel because he's coming up in the next letter, which comes from Marcus. So Marcus writes, remember McAdoo, McAdon't, McAwill, McAwon't? What happened to Bob McAdoo in Detroit? Marcus, you know what I called him on the air? Remember that? Bob McAdog. He's actually, in addition to being a monster talent years ago, he's a very nice guy, but he just didn't play hard. He didn't seem to want to be in Detroit. Happens sometimes. So here we go, Eli. I know you remember it. Red Auerbach picked Dickie V's pocket on that one. The Celtics had signed ML Carr as a free agent, and the Pistons were due compensation back in those days. They couldn't agree on what it was going to be, though. So Red goes public with this campaign. He's screaming to anybody who'll listen, Vitel can ask for anybody he wants, but not Bob McAdoo. No way in hell is he getting Bob McAdoo.
What they got for McAdoo, the Celtics did, is they got a draft pick that enabled them to get Robert Parrish. They traded it to the, and they got Kevin McHale with another part. I'm trying to think who the third
I don't think it was those two draft choices, though, because the draft choices came in 1980. But, you know, yeah. So he took our back.
They traded one to the Warriors for Robert Parrish.
The top
Parrish,
pick over, yeah, the top pick Parrish overall was the choice pick.
Parrish and McHale both came to Boston as a result of the McAdoo fiasco. By the way, McAdoo didn't play here, right? He was McAdog. And after he left here, he enjoyed some very good years with the Celtics. He had plenty of career left. The point is he didn't want to be here. He didn't want to be the twin tower with Bob Lanier. And Tom Wilson told me the story. He says one time he brought him in and he goes, what's with that foot of yours? Your foot can't be that hurt. And McAdoo says, my foot will get a lot better when you bring a point guard in here.
That's not.
You know,
a
his
bad
point
line.
Guard. His point guard was it Ellis or Ellsbury or James? James McElroy was his point
James
guard.
James McElroy, Detroit and Central Michigan. Yeah. So what a great athlete he was. Yeah. Right. So anyway, what happened was Eli's talking about these draft choices. The top one, which was Detroit's pick, was traded away, I think, to Atlanta, and they selected Joe Barely Cares. So that didn't work out too well. But as a result of this railroad robbery, Dickie V was fired. Scotty Robertson and Jack McCloskey came in. And by the next season, both had had enough of Bob McAdog and his attitude, and the Pistons just waved him. Just let him.
And they were able,
any more mailbag or.
And they drafted Isaiah Thomas that year.
Tom
okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I got one for you, Denny.
That's perfect, Denny. I cry. Denny just says, "Let's get Nowatzki on the line." Enough of this. Okay, Bob. Last.
Yeah, you
one.
Know why? Because it's not about him or baseball.
Oh, stop it! Last.
That's
one.
Why he didn't want to hear about basketball.
This
or hockey.
Bag has gone on too long.
All right,
once again,
it's a light mailbag. So this is a good one here, Denny. It's unnamed text. I'm a lifelong Tigers fan, and I miss watching and listening to Tigers baseball. A travesty I've noticed since the 1990s is that Jim Price will give no credit to Denny McClain or his accomplishments. He gives kudos to every other player on the 68 team. I haven't heard him one time tell the famous Mickey Mantle gift pitch story where Jim was Denny's catcher that day. He did not mention who actually threw that famous pitch. Now, I don't know or care if Mr. Price liked or disliked Denny, but to continue to ignore Denny McClain's place and accomplishments is disrespectful to we fans and the history of the great game. Years ago, I talked with Jim Northrup, and Jim Price's name came up. Northam went on a 10-minute tirade about the 68 backup catcher. You can bet it wasn't good, and he says, I love the show, guys. Denny, what about them?
Well, we, for some reason, we've had some kind of a it had something to do with our book, Eli. And I still don't know what it was all about. No. I saw him a couple of times. Yeah, that it was about the book, I was told, by any number of people. So whatever it is, and he'll get over it one day when, as the big Lord in the sky says, I don't need a catcher, but you're good for me right now.
When you're as quality a broadcaster as Jim Price, you have a command of the English language like Jim Price does, when you could make – brilliant comments like, I'm trying to think.
Buggy whip?
He says, brilliant comments like, his future is all in front of him. Stuff like that. You know, you can say what you want.
An arsenal?
Yeah. Arsenal. Yeah,
I'm going to go look in my arsenal again right now okay. And light it up.
I've said this before. I'll just hit one more time, and I defer to you two because you know I'm a hell of a lot better than I do. But I've always had a very friendly, cordial relationship with Jim Price. I hear all the stories going around, most of them negative. Never had a problem with the man in my life.
Well, there's a lot of people that have never had a problem with him.
Which is totally irrelevant to this situation here because you didn't have
well, everybody's slamming him. Everybody's saying what a jerk he is or this or that. I'm just telling you what I saw.
And you know what?
Denny
doesn't care about that, and neither do I, because I have a different relationship with him also. In fact, I was supposed to be the third man in the booth. I got the newspaper articles to prove it in 2003, and it was in the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press that I was hired to be the third man along with Dickerson and Price, and magically, the next day, I wasn't. And there's a reason why that someone felt threatened to have me in the booth with him. Usually, it's somebody with a bad vocabulary and a lot of insecurity, and I'm not going to mention who that might be. So let's move on. Let's talk to our great guest today, Tom Nowotzki, okay?
And Eli, lose the bitterness for the Nowotzki interview, okay?
There's no bitterness with Mr. Nowotzki.
Fullback Tom Nowotzki, who played for the Lions from 65 to 69, was the only Lion of that era to win a Super Bowl and score a TD in it. Yes, in 1970, the year after he left Detroit, Tom played for the Colts in their 16-13 win over Dallas in Super Bowl V. He'd score the game-tying touchdown in the fourth quarter after the great former Wolverine Rick Volk intercepted a Craig Morton pass deep in Colts territory.
Third down. Intercepted. Rick Volk at the 20, at the 10. Volk to the 2. Baltimore, first and goal. Nowotzki again, and he's in. Baltimore's in for the touchdown.
It's Tom Nowotzki tying a game at 13. They went on to win on Jim O'Brien's kick. And Tom joins us now. And Tom, let me guess, you're still wearing that ring, right? You still got it on today?
I think so. Yeah, it's on my finger. I wanted to wear it. Yes. Did you get the thing he said, Nowotzki again? The first time I ran right up the tight end's butt, Tom Mitchell, and I went back to the huddle and said, Earl, run it again. I'll get it for you. And he did.
So you get 1 yard in the first play, and then you scored on the second one.
So for all these years, Earl's gone a long time ago, but Earl used to come up and play in my golf tournament with me. And I always get him that I had to call the plays for him when it got crucial because he didn't know what to do.
Now, let's go back a little bit here because you played 5 years here. You got drafted in 65. I want to get back to your college career later. You had five good seasons. A lot of them, you had five good seasons. The Lions didn't have five good seasons, but 69 was a good season. Why did they release you? You obviously had a lot left, as you proved in Baltimore. That must have been tough. Did you think about retiring? Were you bitter about it? What was that all about? Why'd the Lions give up on you after five good years?
You know, I never really got good answers, okay? You know, Joe Schmidt was the head coach, and Joe's last year playing was my first year here. And one of the reasons I came here, because the Lions had really great players like Karras, Joe Walker, and they got Lucci and Roger Brown and Darius McCord, and they had a lot of great players. But then they fired their coach, and then Harry Gilmer came in, and it was just being a new guy, he didn't learn the ropes until after about third year. And I was surprised that I got let go. But they were going a different way with Amos Marsh and a couple other guys. Oh, they drafted Mel Farr and Nick Eddy. That was their he got hurt getting off the bus, I think. But anyway, that's what they were doing. And luckily, I got picked up with Baltimore after the first game. And it just, we were 16-2-1. So that's not yeah. That's not bad.
Tom, this is Denny. Start in the beginning, because it was a fabulous story you told yesterday about being drafted by both leagues.
Yeah, the Jets took you number 4. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, coming from Indiana, from southern and northern Indiana, as a farm kid, I went to Indiana University and never thought I would be an All-American and be a number one draft choice. That was the year the AFL was fighting with the NFL. So Butkus and I were both drafted by the Jets, and then he was drafted by Chicago in the NFL, and I was by Detroit. So we both told those teams when we were in New York for the Ed Sullivan Show that we weren't going to the AFL. And the Jets turned around and traded Butkus to Denver, hoping Denver could sign him out there because he didn't want to go play in New York. And they drafted Namath. So I always kid Joe about that he was second best.
You mentioned growing up in Michigan City, Indiana, on a 100-acre potato farm, no less. Did you do all that tough farm work, and in a day when they didn't really lift weights that much, did that make you much stronger?
Listen, when I was 9, I had to get up and milk 6 cows in the morning before I went to school. And then my brother and I had to milk them. My dad didn't. My dad worked for the county. And I had to hold the potatoes and I had to do all that stuff. And I got bitched at if I didn't do it right. So,
what a career you had at Indiana. You were an All-American in 64, led the Big Ten in rushing. You set an Indiana record with 73 points. You also played linebacker and kicked, including a 50-yard field goal straight on. But that wasn't two-platoon football back then. What were you doing playing linebacker? I didn't even get that.
Well, I played both positions, even in Baltimore. And this last year I played both places. Back then, you had to play more than one position. I averaged 52 minutes a game in college, okay? Because I was always on the field. And that record is Ohio State. It was the Big Ten record for 50 yards, or NCAA record for, until they started kicking sideways, and then it went away.
Okay. Okay. But Errol Mann couldn't kick a 50-yarder, and you could. Did you?
The thing about it is you were a great high school player, and you're from northern Indiana. Like, duh, you're going to play at Notre Dame. But you didn't.
Lloyd Woodrick and I went there on a Saturday. They were playing Purdue. Bernie Allen was a quarterback for Purdue. And they beat them 52-10. And we got there to get the tickets, and they had to wait 30 minutes for them to find our tickets at Will Call. We went in to sit down, and they said, afterwards, you go see the coach in the locker room. So we went in. They let us in this room, and we could hear him talking to the players. All of a sudden, it got really quiet. After about 15 minutes, I went walking around and said, hey, there ain't nobody here. We went home. That was my visit to Notre Dame.
Jeez, that was it?
So, yeah.
Why did you go to Indiana then over Michigan and Michigan State?
Because Phil Dickens came to my house.
Oh,
the head coach
Indiana,
from
right.
Indiana.
And you were impressed
he
by
came
him,
to my house. And he told me that if I came there, I would play 3 years for him. So
and you did.
I visited Michigan State twice, but I never met any of the coaches because I forget who Earl Morrill was, a Michigan State guy. And
way back.
I don't know who Duffy was the coach.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Bernie Allen. Bernie Allen was my roommate for a while in Washington, D.C.
Is it the same Bernie
Senators.
Allen?
No,
yeah, same Bernie,
Bernie Allen?
Allen.
Yeah, same guy. Now, listen, I want to get back to your signing day. You were offered the same amount of – this is what stunned me, how much money they offered. They offered you $45,000 from each team?
No, they didn't offer that. That's what I wanted. I was in New York and was talking with Russ Thomas on the phone, and then I was talking with Sonny Wiblin from the Jets. And right. I was asking the Jets for $75,000.
Right.
And I had no agent. I had no idea what to do, but I was just reaching up there. And Russ and I had a couple phone calls back and forth, and finally he called me back and said, here's the best we can do. So I got $45,000, a new car for my mom and dad, plus some money to them, and $45,000 to sign, plus $45,000 for 3 years, no cut. So
that was a lot. That was a lot of money. I mean, I know it's not a lot of money, but that was a lot of money back then.
It was. I mean, everybody hated the fact that I was a rookie with all the money, you know, but because laborers at the time were at $2.83 an hour. OK, now they're like 22.
Yeah. So, well, you know, what amazes me, because Lem Barney said, and he got drafted in 67, 2 years after he got his contract was 16, 17 and 18,000. You got 45 is crazy compared to what the some of the other guys got. What did Mel Farr get to sign? I bet it wasn't even that much. In 67.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
But look at the guys.
All
drafted.
I know is everybody that got drafted a couple weeks ago is a millionaire. Okay.
Yeah. More than
I know that.
Look at the great running backs in 64 when you came out. The number one pick was Tucker Fredrickson of Texas. No, he was Tulane.
Auburn.
That's right. You had Gale Sayers got picked next. Donnie Anderson, Mike Garrett. Mm-hmm. These are all great running backs. Grabowski, even in that first round, you had, remember Cosmo Iacovazzi of Princeton? So to get picked in the first round with that amount of guys out there was pretty impressive.
It was great to be a part of that era, okay? And now you talk about and you figure out where football has gone, okay? And what they're going to give Zach in Dallas, what, $38 million a year?
Yeah,
38
that's all.
Million. Okay.
So, Tom,
how about the kid from Michigan State who had the Jets or Michigan State with Pittsburgh a year ago? He held out because he's only making $5.6
million. I know.
No, he wasn't. He was making $14 million, and he walked away from it.
Le'Veon Bell we're talking about.
Bell. Yeah.
Le'Veon Bell. Yeah. Tom, here's what I want to ask you, as opposed to my two cohorts on this show. I am from Detroit, and so – the Lions of the 1960s were gods to my buddies and me. We even had season tickets in 65. So, Tom Nowatzki, wow. Just a little name association, please. Don't talk a lot about any of these guys. Just a couple sentences. I want to start with this. Your quarterback was Milt Plum, at whom Alex Karras threw his helmet following a Milt interception in Green Bay in 1962 that cost the Lions the game. What was Milt Plum like?
Milt was a nice guy, okay, but Earl Moore was a much better quarterback. They kept Milt and got rid of Earl, and I caught up with Earl in Baltimore because he was the quarterback that finished the game in Super Bowl. Okay, Earl was a player's quarterback, and Milt was okay, but he wasn't that great. Okay, in my opinion.
Next question, Bob.
All right. Then I want to tell you this. All of us went out to the football fields of our youth, and we pretended we were these two guys catching touchdown passes. Gale Cogdill, one of my biggest heroes, and Pat Studstill. What were they like?
They were really overachievers. I mean, Gale had really quick moves. Pat was a little guy that overcame a lot of adversity because of his size. And he did well with what he had to deal with, okay? I mean, he's not a current receiver with a 6'4" and got blazing speed, but Gale was really good. Okay, we had adequate receivers. We had Ron Kramer as a tight end.
Terry
Jim
Barr.
Gibbons was the other side. Okay, so yeah. Why we didn't win more than six or seven games? I think we had more of a defensive problem than anything else. And I don't know why that happened, but
over the years, who was the best coach you think you played for?
Had to be Joe.
Don McCaffrey.
Oh, really? McCaffrey. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, his in first Baltimore, year he won the Super Bowl. You know why? Because he let his assistants coach.
Oh.
Okay. He was the head coach, and he listened to the problems you had, and you could suggest, hey, Don, we got to do this. And if you see the films in Baltimore, before I went in the game, he was always had his hand around me, telling me to do this, do that, and tell John to do this. You know, in Baltimore, in here, when Harry Gilmer came in, he wanted to run everything. Okay, and when you run a company, you got to have good assistants. Yep. So let him work, okay? He didn't, okay?
Interesting.
And that was my introduction to coaching with Harry Gummer.
Ownership in Baltimore changed. Your last year was 72. You start 1-4. Then the general manager, Joe Thomas, ordered McCaffrey to bench 39-year-old John Unitas. This is the story, is that McCaffrey refused to bench him, and he was fired. Then he came here, coached in 73, and died mowing his lawn in July 74. Is that a true story? A coach refusing to bench his quarterback and getting fired for it? That's amazing.
I believe it is. The Klosterman was a jerk. Okay, first of all, the guy that owns the Indianapolis Colts, the person owner, he was a jerk. I mean, we met him. We were playing an exhibition game in Tampa Friday night. And who's that guy on the marker? He tripped over the yard marker and fell down because he was drunk. And that's Bob Irsay.
Jeez.
That was our introduction to Bob Irsay, okay? Now, his son, I understand, is doing a little bit better job, but doesn't he have some problems with drugs or something, too?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yep.
But, Baltimore was going downhill after that. But Baltimore was a prestige, you know, between the Lions and the Bears in Green Bay and Baltimore, that was the cream of the crop of the NFL.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when I went there, it was I always thought I went from the outhouse to the penthouse, you know, and it turned out to be that. So wait.
What was it like to play with Johnny U? How did he treat you?
John is one of my best friends. He had the golden arms. We went there every Friday night, and he said I got to pay $1,200 to have him cut down these trees. And I said, John, buy a power saw for $200. So I cut him down on Monday. So I went out to his house and did that. And the last one, I was cutting it, and it almost got done and ran out of gas. Well, the tree turned and missed his house by about 5 feet.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was a little traumatic. But John was a great guy. Ted Hendricks, Dan Sullivan, Earl Morrill, and John and I went out to dinner every night on a road trip, okay, on the night before a game. Wherever we were, we went out, the five of us went to dinner together. And John was a really good guy, okay? You didn't talk back to him. First practice, after practice, I'm walking off the field, and he says, where are you going? I said, I'm going in. He says, not if you want to play with me or not. Get out here. So after practice, he had the receivers in the backs run patterns because he wanted to know what your movement was at 5 yards or at 12 yards because everybody's the same. They run the same type of way. Their hands move and so on and so forth. You never saw him throw the ball to you. It was there. A lot of what is happening today, a lot of the quarterbacks today are all throwing the ball well before the guy breaks open.
Oh, I know.
Okay?
You know, with your career and the number of teams you played with and all the people that you met in the game, did you get an offer to coach, head coach ever?
No, you know, I kick myself sometimes in the butt for doing what I'm doing. Okay, I'm a dealer for heavy-duty trucks and trailers. Now I got a 24-hour gas station in Whitmore Lake, and I really am trying to find somebody to buy it because I want to retire. I'll be 78 in September. But, yeah, I thought I could be a good coach because I understood both sides of the game.
Sure.
And I understood people, okay? I feel like I'm a good reader of people, okay? Because when you go in to see somebody and you're going to sell them $1 million worth of equipment, you better have together, okay?
Yeah, because, and you know what? We've known each other a long time, but you look like a coach. You know what I mean? I mean, you really do. You look like a coach. You look like a guy who's in control. You want to do your own shtick. You want to make sure you're out front. You want to do all the right things. I just don't understand why not. Did you ever pursue it?
No, I didn't. I should have when McCaffrey was here and I retired that first year because I went to see him a month before he passed away.
Oh.
And I should have followed up. But you know, you asked me that question about coaches. I tell you, he was a good coach. Ooh. But he sometimes couldn't relate to players like he should have as Joe Schmidt. Mm-hmm.
If we could, back to a couple more of my childhood Detroit Lions heroes. I'm just going to mention this name, and Tom, you take it away. For the younger people who've never heard of him, Joe Don Looney.
Oh, my God.
Joe Don Looney came from Washington here my rookie year, okay? And he was going to be next to me in the backfield, right? First play, Tiger Stadium, Friday night. We're playing the Baltimore Colts, by the way. And the plays to me as I take two steps, and there's Joe right in my face. And he's pointing at me. I said, wait a minute, you went the wrong way. First play of the game, he went the wrong way. He didn't last too long. In training camp, the second year, he was out almost every night, and they caught him. And
an amazing talent.
Amazing talent. Okay. Benny, you played with a lot of guys in baseball that had all that talent, but didn't know how to use it.
1966, you're the leading Lions rusher by over 80 yards over Amos Marsh, and yet football was different back then. 520 yards would lead the team in rushing. You also led the team in touchdowns that year, and you led the team with 54 catches, more than Studstill and more than Cogdill and Kramer. No, second to Studstill and more than Cogdill and Kramer. It was a very different game back then, though, and you don't see, you didn't see Pat Mahomes, and you didn't see Lamar Jackson scoring 40, 50 points a game. It was a very defensive-minded game. Has it changed that much, and is it because the influx of great black athletes, let's put it that way, that have changed the way the game is played in a more speed and open game?
Well, everybody is a lot faster. There's so much speed in the game, okay? The rules have changed. You can't touch a defense. I mean, you know, Raymond Berry used to get knocked down before John would throw him the ball. Okay, now you can't do that. I mean, so it's on the offense. It's all offense right now. It's really hard for a defensive player to keep a guy away from catching the ball if the quarterback knows where he's going to throw it and he knows where that guy's going, because there's a small window there. When he breaks, the ball's coming. It's open, okay? It's very hard. It's the speed of the game. I mean, you got guys now, they don't draft running backs or receivers if they can't run 4-4 or 4-3, okay? I was 4-5-5, I think, a speed in a 40, okay? And that probably wouldn't make it today, you know? So it has changed a lot. It just has. Okay.
When's the last time you talked to Ray Berry?
Oh God, it was in Baltimore a long time ago. Is he still alive?
I was with him at a card show about a year ago. He looks great. It looks like he can play.
Yeah. I got asked those questions now. Is he still alive? You know, I said Mike Curtis passed away.
He's alive.
Leaving. And you don't know it, you know?
And I'll tell you, at the show that I was at with Raymond, he had a line from here to Guam. The line was just unbelievable. And this was in Nashville, where he lives.
Yeah. He's a pretty good guy. Okay.
Yeah, he really is.
Hey, I looked it up because I didn't remember you in the cast. How come you weren't in Paper Lion? Everybody else on the team was. Did you not go down to Florida? Because you were with them when they did that in 67.
I had lunch at the Lions alumni weekend the day before Alan Alden passed away. It was Sunday, and Monday he passed away. But I was in Florida for 10 weeks, but my son was to be born shortly. I couldn't stay 16 weeks, so I had no part. I was a rookie that year, and I was there for 10 weeks, but I didn't have a part, okay? Lucci and all those guys did. But in order to have a part, you had to have been the whole time at the shooting. So
I want to play a little snippet for you here just to remember, because I didn't really know Van Patrick. He was on the air before me, but he was the voice of the Lions all through Bob's youth and all the time when you played. Here's a little snippet, if you do recognize his voice, from the highlight film from 1967. Play it, Brandon.
Tom Nowatzki pulls up the middle for the final blow as the Lions romp over the Browns 31-14.
Oh, that's... I had to throw that in.
Man, that doesn't happen very often anymore.
But we got to talk
about
it.
Wasn't Bob Reynolds in there too?
I think he
did. Not there, but he would have been there. Yeah, for sure. Tom, we got to talk about what's been going on in Detroit. You've never left the Detroit Ann Arbor area. Ex-NFL and Detroit Lion. Is it just Bill Ford and Russ Thomas? I'm sure you got some stories about him.
He liked Russ,
and then, of course,
I think.
Matt Millen. I mean, what is wrong with this sad sack franchise?
Well, Bill Ford was a hard guy to get to know. You only saw him after games. He never came to practice, very seldom. When I went to Baltimore, the owner was there all the time for practice, okay? He was one of the guys, okay? And I don't know what the problem is, but they seem to have problems selecting good coaches, okay? And then when Joe came in, Joe needed some better assistants. He had Sammy Ball, okay? I learned more from Ron Kramer after practice than Sammy Ball. He was my offensive backfield coach, okay? They don't seem to make the right decisions. I'm not sure they made the right one now, okay? Only because they had a really bad season, okay? They got to come out 3-5, okay? 3 out of 5 to start with, or they're going to go in the house. Yeah. People are going to give up on them this year. That's what I think, okay? I don't know these coaches at all. I'm out of the game for a long time, but the results is what count. You know,
and hiring coaches is obviously in the bailiwick of the owner of a football team.
That's right.
And Bill Ford was the longtime constant through Harry Gilmer, through all of these guys we've been talking about.
I maintain that if Bill Ford Jr. had the team, it would be a lot different.
I agree.
They shut him off to the automobile thing where he's doing really good, okay? Yeah. And I think that I like him a lot, okay?
Yeah.
And I went to somewhere to a show, and he came up and says, Tom, did you realize I was 7 years old when you came with the Lions?
Did you have any kind of a relationship with Russ Thomas?
No, not really. He was sort of aloof, you know. He thought he was better than everybody, didn't have to mingle with the players.
And he wasn't. He certainly wasn't.
Usually those people aren't. You don't gain respect by being aloof. You gain respect by doing something, okay?
Yep.
And, you know, the Nick Eddy thing, the Mel Farr anything, that put him behind at least 3 years, okay? So.
What do you mean the Mel Farr thing? What do you mean by that?
Well, just drafting them. They weren't that good. Okay.
Mel Farr wasn't that good. Well, he got hurt.
No, he wasn't that good. He couldn't block. Okay. He could run the ball, but he couldn't.
You're talking as a fullback now.
You couldn't depend on him to make a block.
You blocked because you were a fullback.
Yeah, well, I did.
In fact, I want to ask you that. I was watching we played the clip of you scoring the touchdown in the Super Bowl, and you just, as you say, you smash into the line. When you look back and think of what you did for all those years, college, high school, pro, I mean, what a punishing position. I look at running backs and I say, he's going to get the ball and know that 11 guys are going to try and take his head off, and he still runs right into them as if it doesn't matter. When you look at the game and think of the game and how you're 78 years old, fullback, man, the punishment. Did you ever wonder, what am I doing?
Yeah, well, back then the game was such that you either carried the ball and got beat on, or you blocked a big defensive end or a linebacker, okay? Now they have one back, and he's half the time out in patterns, and they don't block anybody on three-quarters of the plays, okay? So, I always felt like my head's fine, okay? There's nothing wrong. I always felt like I needed to know when I had to get in the ground, because you can't struggle very long because they're coming. And if you're going to just have a guy hold your leg and you're going to struggle, you're going to get your clock cleaned, okay?
Yeah.
And so I just had to get on the ground and come back the next time.
Yeah, because he took my question from any head injuries or anything from the past, but you sound sharp as hell. Yesterday, you were still sharp as hell.
Not yet, man. I don't have anything going on.
But you got two
yet.
New knees.
Yeah. How many new parts?
It doesn't make him a good head.
How many body parts have you had redone?
Just the knees. I had a cortisone shot in my left shoulder. They want to replace that, but I'm not going to let them for a while.
With it.
Because if they do that, you can only lift 25 pounds, and I can't do that. So, you know, it's arthritis is what's coming in, you know, with that. So, but my mom lived to be 97, so maybe I got 20 more years left.
God bless her. That's terrific.
Isn't that something?
Okay. Tell everybody now what you're doing, and your son also.
Well, my son Tom, I'm a dealer for heavy duty trucks and trailers. I got a 24,000 square foot building and 10 mechanics. We do work on trucks and trailers every day, and I put in Marathon fuel. I have 3 diesel pumps, 4 gas pumps. We're open 24/7 at North Territorial and 23, just north of Ann Arbor. My son is a TNT trailer in Canton. He's a Wabash dealer. He's got 42 employees. I got 24.
Wow.
That's what I'm doing now, but I'm looking for somebody to come in and take it over, because I need to go up north to my Avalog home up north and 200 acres up there. So,
Well, I'll borrow the money from Eli. I'll bring it over tomorrow.
Bob, your last question. Go ahead.
Tom, this is my last question for you, and I ask this on behalf of all older Detroit Lions fans listening right now. In 1966, you beat out my hero, Nick Petrosani, to become fullback of the Lions. So were you guys really competitive with each other? Did that affect your relationship? And Nick, of course, died so young of cancer. What was
he did. He did. He did. I liked Nick. When I was in school, Nick was at Notre Dame. And he's about 3 years ahead, 4 years ahead of me, something like that. And, you know, Harry Gilmer comes in, and Nick's here, and I'm here. and they trade him to Cleveland that summer, that training camp. Okay, and then Joe Don Lutie's in, and so I didn't get, I got to work out with Nick at U of D before we went to training camp, because that's what the players were doing. And in August or July, you would work out over there because they give us facilities. And then, but I went Nick to dinner a couple times. I liked him. There's nothing, wrong with him. Go ahead and I'm sorry to see him leave, but I had no decision in it. They traded him over there during training camp, and he only lasted about 3 more years, and he passed away.
My last thing is that, of course, it wasn't only me, but I'll take partial credit. I'm on the voting committee for the National Polar Sports Hall of Fame. You were inducted in 2008. I promised them I would mention it today because it is a wonderful organization with some amazing athletes. You're stunning me. Look at the great Polish athletes.
Everywhere I go, I tell them that is the greatest organization that I belong to. That or the Gridiron Greats with Ditka and myself and a few other people were formed to help out players. But now there's so much money, you don't need an organization to help out players. They got their own. So, the Polish Hall of Fame is a great organization. My problem is it's over on the east side, and it takes me an hour and 20 minutes to get there. So I don't even go over there for lunch because it takes me 3 hours to go have lunch. But it's a great organization. My mom was Polish. Her name was Kobazinski. My dad was German. Nowatzki's German, but I gave up a long time ago explaining how I'm German. So and that's it.
Great organization. So, great organization. Denny and I do a lot of stuff over there. I host the Michigan State Night every year, and we had a little roast for Denny. Raised some money for the what is the parade on Labor Day? There's the Polish parade,
Warren, right? City of Warren, something like that.
Tom, great talking to you again. Continued good health with those new knees and everything, and hopefully you get your price for your business and get to retire up north enjoy the rest of your days. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. See
you.
Okay,
have a good one. Thanks, bye-bye. Tommy. You were great. This is for Bob. Bottom line is, Eli and I chose to live in Michigan. Bob, you were born here. You had no choice.
I was born in Covington, Kentucky.
Well, wherever you were born, okay, you came had no here, choice. And whatever. But Eli and I chose to make this our home. So, we think a lot of Michigan.
Yeah, I think a lot of Michigan, too, between May and September.
Why do you live in
September.
Florida and New York? Oh, come on.
Between May and September is when I think of Michigan. And you know who I wanted to ask him about? We just kind of ran out of time there. He played with Dick Knight Train Lane.
Yeah,
he did. He played with everybody.
So many guys from my childhood I could ask him.
All right. Good guy. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Dick Trusewski, who is hilarious, will join us on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Have a good one, guys. Stay safe.
Bye, everybody.